the talk of planet Earth.
We call it
TalkZone.com. Internet talk radio.
And we know you're going to love it.
TalkZone.com.
Susan Frank talks to the animals and you. It's Wild About Pets on TalkZone.com.
Welcome back to the show and our discussion with my guest, Jennifer Arnold, founder of Canine Assistance, a service dog school, and the author of Through a Dog's Eyes, Understanding Our Dogs by Understanding How They See the World. Our theme today is Jennifer has taught dogs, service dogs, to respond to cues and do highly complicated things, much more than most of us would be teaching our dogs. And since her methods work so well with those kind of complex behaviors, we can learn so much from her methods and her philosophy. The phone lines are open today. If you want to ask Jennifer Arnold a question, call 888-463-6748. I'll repeat that, 888-463-6748. The numbers are also at the top of the page of photos, and you can see pictures that we're referring to by clicking the purple Look While You Listen button that's on today's November 12th episode page or on my Talk Zone Wild About Pets homepage. So right before break, Jennifer, we left off with the idea of that perhaps this idea that we must be the alpha, we must be dominant over the pets, is not what is needed for our dogs to cooperate with us. But here's my question. Often we do hear the stories in a household where maybe the dog listens to one member of the family but completely doesn't, or it seems like the dog is in control. It's stealing food. It's pushing people out of the bed. It's taking the space of a spouse. It's just like almost out of control. And I think these families are the ones who think, uh-oh, the dog's in control here, not me. How do we address that issue?
Well, I do think that's a leadership issue, and that's going to sound, you know, obviously, that sounds strange coming from me, but it's not. Dogs obviously cannot drive themselves to the pet store to buy a high-quality food. You know, we clearly have to be in control.
Mm-hmm, okay.
And I think that what we have to do is, rather than, you know, dominate them and use fear or force, rather we need to sort of parent or coach them. I mean, they are foreign creatures living in a very foreign land, and, you know, they don't understand things well. And what I've seen in those situations is that the dog is having a very hard time understanding one person and understands the other person better. And even if that person intimidates, even if the one that the dog listens to is more intimidating, it's not the intimidation that's getting through. It's the fact the dog can understand the message.
Ah, that's really important. That's worth repeating. It's not the intimidation that's the response from the dog. It's that the message is clearer.
Right.
Okay, we're going to get into how you deliver these messages, but before we do that, let's talk a little bit about some of the fascinating things that you learned through all these years observing and working with these wonderful dogs, which basically informs a lot of what your book deals with. How do dogs perceive and experience their world? And obviously we know a lot of through the senses. So tell us a little some of the highlights. And here on picture number 8, we've got this dog. The idea is, well, how do they see the world? What can you tell us briefly about their senses that maybe we're not so aware of?
Well, interestingly enough, at least it was to me when I first learned it, dogs don't see our world very clearly at all. I thought dogs had fabulous vision.
Mm-hmm. I think I thought that too.
And when I realized and was taught that dogs actually have very poor visual acuity, so they don't see detail well. And you know how human beings are evaluated and given a score, like your vision is 20/20.
Mm-hmm.
That means that you can see from 20 feet away what most people can see from 20 feet away. Under that scoring system, dogs actually have vision that's about 2080 to 2100. So they would need glasses if they to see the chalkboard.
However, and I love how you describe this, dogs are very good at observing our behavior, reading very fine gestures, and you even talk about how we can cue dogs sometimes by nothing more than our eyes. So how is that that dogs don't have great vision, but they're so tuned in to looking and observing us?
Well, I mean, two things there. Oh, number one, I think it's so incredibly important to them because they recognize that their survival is dependent on our goodwill.
Mm-hmm.
So they try very hard. And the other thing is that dogs do have tremendously good vision in two ways. They have great night vision, and they have incredible vision for motion.
Oh, okay. And when we're doing things, like gesturing or moving or
right.
positioning our bodies, they detect that.
Very easy for them to cue in. And then, you know, dogs, if we're a visual species, dogs are a species that live through smell.
Yes, yes.
Remarkable sense of smell. You know, all the numbers, I mean, that scientists come up with, that, you know, dogs may be able to smell 100,000 times better than people. We really have no way of putting a number on that. Their ability to discern different odors when mixed in a group is stunning to me. Like, I think the example that I use in the book is they don't smell beef stew. They smell meat, you know, onions, carrots, celery, potatoes. They can smell different components of every odor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's so cool. And all right, so, Chris, you answer this question nicely, and everyone wants to know this, so I've got to ask this. So, okay, we know they love smelling things that maybe we would find totally revolting. Why is it, Jennifer, that our dogs want to roll in and coat themselves with the most stinky stuff that we can find imaginable and then come back into our homes with that?
Well, the most logical explanation that I can find for that really does come from their wolf ancestry, and that is that wolves, when they would hunt and have a kill, would often roll in whatever was left over, and then they would walk back to the area where everybody was denning, so that the other members of their family could smell what was on the menu and then could follow the trail back to the source.
Mm, okay, sure.
So I think that probably when you realize that the vast majority of what our dogs roll in that's stinky is edible to a dog, that makes a lot more sense. In case you don't want to cook tonight, Mom, I wanted to let you know there is a dead squirrel.
Right out, you know,
right.
500 yards from here. So that's another helpful hint from our dogs. You know, in your book, you have these great chapters that elaborate basically what I was saying, that all these insights about how they see the world. And clearly in our hour, we're not going to have enough time to talk about all of them. I want to call attention to the fact that you have a whole chapter on canine cognition, what we know of and think is going on and what you've observed maybe is happening mentally. And I just have to call attention to photograph number 9. All these photos basically are from your Facebook page, and I want to refer everybody to them. When Jennifer was talking about all the puppies that they breed, you can see adorable photos. But I love this picture, Jennifer, and, you know, I put the person who submitted to you, this dog looks so smart.
He does look highly intelligent, doesn't he?
Yes, and it's not just the tie and the collar. No, you can tell there's something going on there. And so you refer to that and how dogs need to figure things out. But I also want to move ahead to picture number 11, emotion. And I learned something in your book that I think I had not known. And so I want to talk a little bit about this. And I know it's controversial. Oh, do dogs have emotions? Do they really feel what we feel? And you address that. Any dog owner clearly will tell you, well, of course my dog has emotions. I love this picture from your canine assistance website. This positively looks like both this child and dog are smiling and are just in bliss being
together.
Is
that an incredible photograph?
I
mean,
yes.
Looking at the expression on the dog's face, that loose mouth,
mm-hmm.
so soft, just pouring out affection.
So let's actually talk about a little bit of that. Let's get into what dogs can tell us, because in picture number 12, I am quoting right from your book that the dogs communicate with us through vocalizations, facial expressions, odor secretions, intricate body positions and movements. I think, Jennifer, sometimes we have a general idea of we know what they mean, but you impress in your book that there's a lot of things we may be misreading. Can you tell us a couple that you most would want to relate on things that we literally can look for in our dogs that will help us maybe better understand what they are communicating to us?
Well, I think the big one that people often misunderstand is, you know, the tail wag.
Okay, tell us about that.
Dogs who have their tails held up, they're held up by muscular tension. There is not a piece of wire running through the dog's tail making it stay up. So that, you know, if the dog's tail is high up, you know that that's a dog that has some tension in their body. Now, some tension is normal and good, but dogs who are very uncomfortable and potentially threatening to people because of that lack of comfort, that fear, will wag their tail sometimes. But it's a very, very, very tight little motion. And so don't assume that a wagging tail means a happy dog.
Okay.
And I would say that we tend to look at the corners of the mouth. The commissure is what it's called, and we want to see relaxed, whether the dog's mouth is open or closed. Anybody can tell what a clamped, looking mouth or a mouth that's so wide open looks like, and I think that's an important spot to check. And then their ears give you the other indication of, you know, dogs that have their ears up are sort of curious and seeking, and dogs that have their ears back are more serious.
You go into these very specifics, and I loved this also in your book, in addition to the wonderful stories and the science and that you're quoting from, you also are very specific. You tell us, okay, this is what, you know, the mouth or the tail might look like if the dog is feeling this or experiencing that. And so there's much more of this detail than in your book that we can go into. So as you said, in photograph number 11 and maybe even 12, where we have pictures of dogs, one looks like it's smiling, and then 12 where the dog mouth is open. These are relaxed.
But the semi-relaxed.
Okay.
If you look at number 12, mm-hmm. what I would say looking at that photograph that I had not seen before is, you know, a lot of times dogs aren't super comfortable with cameras right in their face.
Sure.
And you notice that the dog's eyes are averted.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the ears that bother me, and maybe because of the dog's black, I can't really see the position of the ears very clearly, but they're kind of slick back. So certainly 11 looks like a happy dog. Just not positive about 12.
Right. Yes. It's hard to say. It just looks like obviously this dog seems to be communicating something, whether this is a bark.
And I'm hoping that the dog is just looking at a person that's to the side of the person taking the picture.
Right.
Otherwise, I think the dog would be saying, please don't take my picture.
Yes. I don't like this. Well, let's talk a little bit about stress, because you do mention that often our dogs are stressed and we don't know it. And you talk about what are called some displacement activities or calming or cutoff signals. What do you mean by these?
Well, displacement behaviors are behaviors that dogs use to reduce tension. And, you know, every animal really has some, every mammal, higher sort of thinking mammal, has behaviors that allow them to feel calmer. In human beings, it might be smoking, chewing your fingernails, eating brownies, drinking. I mean, there are displacement behaviors that you see in people all the time. And what displacement behaviors do is they keep that individual from sort of blowing into pieces.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Stress is, I think of it as a water balloon, and when stress is still coming into the balloon, unless you prick little holes, and the little holes are the displacement behaviors, the balloon's gonna burst. And I think people often perceive what dogs do as displacement behaviors as misbehaviors. And that just makes the whole situation so much worse. Mm-hmm. And it's very sad. Mm-hmm. You know, a dog that tears up every piece of paper in your house when you leave is not angry with you. They're not punishing you. That's a displacement behavior because they're very uncomfortable.
And they're stressed. So we must try and then find out or figure out what it is that's stressing the dog.
Right. Why are you doing this? I mean, barking can be a displacement behavior. And instead of, you know, just shocking the dog until they no longer vocalize, it makes a lot more sense to try to figure out what it is that the dog's trying to accomplish.
No, I know that's a complex question, Jennifer, and obviously there's case-by-case basis, but is there anything you can say about, well, how would you start to go about figuring that out, what's wrong?
Well, I mean, for behaviors like, you know, that seem like they might be separation motivated, you know, dogs mm-hmm. that tear things up when you're gone,
mm-hmm.
or dogs that, you know, pee or poop on your bed, or... I mean, that's probably a marking behavior, more of a come home, you know, this is where we belong sort of behavior. It could just be that the animal's so uncomfortable and was in the room that smelled the most of you and had an accident, but it is also likely to be used as a come home signal. So the first thing you need to do with those behaviors, like chewing, is decide whether it's just boredom or it's true distress.
Okay.
If it's true distress, and the way you decide that really is either a nanny cam or, you know, you get as many sort of puzzly kind of toys as you can to occupy the dog. We recommend stuffing a hollow toy like a Kong toy with low-fat cottage cheese in the dog's kibble and freezing it.
Yeah, I like that idea.
And you know what I have found for us, sort of the definitive test, because we work a lot with breeds that are fairly robust eaters, if I leave food out, like a piece of cheese, something the dog would not normally get but wouldn't be harmful to the dog, and the person puts that out and they go away, and when they come back, if the cheese is still there, it's not boredom. And so when you see that, you realize that the dog is, you know, stressed. And a lot of times in animals, like in humans, the stress messes us up so badly chemically that there really is very little way to get this under control without medication.
Mm-hmm.
That's not always the case. But in serious cases, you know, I feel like, I mean, people say I love my dog so much, I'd never make my dog take medication for this. Well, I think sometimes you have to love them enough to let them take it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, just like with us, as you were mentioning, there could be some sort of chemical imbalance that can just be restored.
Absolutely. And mm-hmm. you can wean them back off of it mm-hmm. sometimes when
Makes
things
sense.
Are better. So.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Referring to what we can look at or how we can help determine maybe what's going on with the dog, I like on pages 114, 115, it's in your chapter on language, that you do describe, let's say, what the dog may be feeling. Like, I'm a happy dog. What to look for? I love you. I'm relaxed. But then I'm anxious. I'm very afraid. I don't understand what you want, but I'm trying. Please don't be mad. And what you do is you help us look at the hot spots, as you say. Look at their lips. Look at the tail. What would the eyes, the ears be doing? What would be the indicators? And so I think that's great and useful for also trying to, you know, figure out, well, what could be going wrong with our pet right now.
Well, you know, I think a lot of, and honestly, so often, and it's just a tragic situation for both sides, but so often when you hear about, you know, family dogs who bite, I mean, the dog did everything but send an email.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think that people have some responsibility to learn what you know, what stress or anxiety or fear looks like in their dog.
Yes.
In
yes.
order to protect them.
Right. And what I find valuable about your book, Jennifer, is there's a sensitivity to it. I mean, we can see some of this kind of material, but sometimes I found it's just too hard and fast. Like, this is what it will be. And your book, through your stories, your anecdotes, your actual experience working with these dogs who have to, you know, deal with very difficult situations also, often it goes into it a little bit deeper. You have an unusual perspective that I found very helpful.
I'm glad.
What I want to spend our last time talking about is your method of what you call teaching, not even training, called choice teaching. And first of all, Jennifer, why do you like to use the word teach instead of train when you apply it to dogs?
Well, I feel like training connotes a physical behavior, really, that you... You know, training makes me think about you're training for the Olympics, and that you want one specific or multiple specific behaviors. But I really don't think that's what most of us want from our dogs. I think what most of us want from our dogs is for them to learn to be good family members. And in order to do that, you can't just teach them to sit. Or train them to sit on cue. You need to teach them under what circumstances it might be appropriate to do that. It also allows the dog, if you have a dog who thinks through situations, they're likely to come up with the right answer a lot better than, you know, if you have a dog that's learned to sit when you pull up on the leash and collar, mm-hmm. What happens when you don't have the leash and collar? You know, what happens if you've got a mouthful of peanut butter and you can't say the word? You know, I mean, it just...
Right, I see, right. And so you advocate a lot using nonverbal cues.
Well, that's what they understand
uh-huh.
the best by far. You know, dogs don't speak human. So they're very good at watching our bodies. They've had to be, or we would have booted them out. So.
Right.
Making use of that makes a lot of sense to me. And then allowing the dog to make the correct decision teaches the dog to process situations and, you know, come up with the best plan.
Now, one of my favorite parts in your book is where you talk about, you lay out some things that I think we may have some wrong ideas about, and you call them dogisms, and one of them has to do with the idea of speaking human. Now, we know all dog lovers and dog owners can communicate in many ways to their dogs, and we believe that, yes, they can understand some of our words, and we do think we can talk to the dogs, but would you say, Jennifer, that we are somehow going a little too far and we're expecting more out of these dogs than is the reality? So what is your dogism about that they don't really speak in human? They don't totally, you know,
they don't get it. Yeah. It's like having a foreign exchange student in your home. The dogs, you know, they really don't understand our language. Clearly they learn certain words.
Mm-hmm.
They may associate them also with certain actions, but, I mean, I know for a fact that my dogs, because I've tested the poor things a zillion times, I mean, there are words that they know very clearly. There are words that I can spell, and they still know, which kind of gives you an indication of how little they really depend on the actual language. But I think it's important that we remember that if you say, now, Roosevelt, don't eat the ham, while I'm out in the yard, the dog has no clue what you're talking about and is going to eat the ham.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're going to be mad.
Right.
You're going to think, I told you not to do that. You knew better.
Right. And that's not the case. They
no.
don't know better.
You know what? That's one of the dogisms. When you feel like saying, now you knew better, what you really should be saying is, I knew better than to let you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, dogs can be brilliant as dogs, but remember, they're two-year-olds. I mean, they are toddlers, and that's one of the reasons that punishment is so unfair. What most of us think of when we think of punishment, you know, something unpleasant or painful or scary for the dog, is completely unfair because the dog has no idea what you're talking about or how to make it any better.
Mm-hmm. What is choice teaching? You talk about that you allow the animals, and you work with so many of them, clearly, to choose something that would be in its best interest. So give us an example of what do you mean by choice teaching? Take us through maybe some
stuff. We all have to do what's in our best interest in order to survive. And that's one thing that I think is also very important for people to remember. We all have to, or we wouldn't survive. So the idea that a dog will do something because you said so doesn't make any sense. All right, so what we do, and like with our puppies when we start, and it works for adult dogs too, we take a spoon, long handle wooden spoon, mostly because we're all too old to run hunched over for very long, and we dip it in peanut butter and we freeze it. And we start in a safely enclosed area. People can start in their houses. And when that peanut butter's frozen, we hold it in our hand. And if the dog walks calmly beside us, then he gets to lick the peanut butter. And if he runs off, you don't say a word about it, because actually they're being corrected because the reward is no longer available. So they're correcting themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so our puppies, before we even put a leash and collar on them, already feel most comfortable when they walk relatively closely beside you. And that's all. We're not looking for an obedience kind of heel for competition. We just want the dog on a loose leash next to us and feeling comfortable there.
Which is how most people are going to want to walk their dogs.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And you don't want the dog. You just don't want to have a sled dog unless you have a sled dog and you like being pulled down the sidewalk like one of my friends does, which is perfectly fine.
Yeah, well, I remember as a child we had a beagle, and I've got to tell you, Jennifer, as a young kid, I found it very unpleasant, and I didn't want to walk Barney. I loved Barney, but he would drag me, and I felt out of control, and I was scared, and I was clueless.
Somebody had told you that if you just put a yummy piece of milk bone in your hand, that Barney would have walked right next to you.
And nobody told me. We didn't know what to do or where to go to read.
And, wouldn't that have been a great idea instead of having to choke the dog? And the thing that people sometimes don't realize is that you don't have to keep the food there forever. That's sort of the starter. And I believe in the book I made reference to, going to random reinforcement where you give the dog a food treat only occasionally. And that's really misnamed. I should have said, you always reinforce a dog when they're doing the right thing, in some way, with kind words or a pat, but the bonus rewards start coming, on a random schedule. And that keeps the dogs more interested, really, than feeding them every time they do something for you.
That's good to know, because I think people think, positive reinforcement training, you always have to be feeding them, and the only way they're going to do it is so they know they're going to get something. That is not true.
I have an interesting thought on that.
Okay.
I think the dogs actually perceive, because they're so into context, because they don't speak human, when they evaluate a circumstance, they take everything into consideration. And because of that, I think that dogs actually believe that the food lure is part of the request for the behavior. So that when it's missing, it's not that the dog is holding you up for food.
Mm-hmm.
They don't recognize the cue. It's not the same.
Okay, and of course, because we know you even talk about situational specificity, which is a mouthful, but it's the idea that sometimes if people find that their dog will go to a spot when they're in the house, but if you ask them to go to a spot when they're outside, it's like the dog never learned it.
Right.
The transfer has to be taught over and over in different places.
Well, just think about it again, sort of as a foreign language. And a foreign language to a toddler at that, you've got to make it very clear that when you say sit, or you cue the dog to do a behavior, it means the same thing on grass as it does on concrete. And that's really not stupid. When you think about it, that's actually quite bright. of the dog to be able to distinguish, you know, so much about their individual settings. But yes, we tend to get impatient with it.
Yes. You talk about choice teaching does require some patience. It may not be this automatic, you know, rote, robotic response.
Right.
But it will be highly rewarding, and it allows a happier life, as I perceive you're saying, for you and your canine.
Well, you know, and I don't care if it's not choice teaching. You know, people say, well, different trainers have different perspectives and different methods. And you know what? I think because of the fact that I'm not a pet dog trainer, I feel more comfortable in saying there are lots of different methodologies that I feel are absolutely appropriate. Any methodology, however, that in any way involves frightening or hurting the dog physically or emotionally is not just a different methodology, it's abuse.
Mm-hmm. That's a great way to summarize this. I do want to call attention to Appendix A. I love this. This is towards the end of the book, and it gives us the different marker, the word you may use, when you're going to use it, what the spoken cue, what the physical cue is, and some of the teaching tips. Would you say, my last question, Jennifer, is it good to do a spoken and the nonverbal, the physical cue, both?
It kind of depends. Yes, it is.
Okay.
Because at some point, you know, your dog is going to have to listen to, you know, there's going to be some circumstance where the dog's not going to be able to see you.
Okay.
And so you start that way. The physical cue is so easy for the dog to recognize that you have to actually be very patient when weaning on to the verbal cue alone.
Okay. We are out of time. My guest has been Jennifer Arnold, founder of Canine Assistance, a service dog school, and the author of Through a Dog's Eyes, Understanding Our Dogs by Understanding How They See the World. You will find the link to Canine Assistance website and the Facebook page, as well as how to order Jennifer's book, at the bottom of the page of photos for today's show. Jennifer, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, my great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. I just want to remind you of those upcoming events for Chicagoland, the day with Temple Grandin at For Your Canine on November 20th, and the adoption event where I will also be demonstrating some pet first aid techniques, two locations of the Pet Supplies Plus stores, December 5th and December 12th. See the additional resources section below for more information about these events. Remember, all my shows are archived for your on-demand 24/7 listening. Write me at susan@wildaboutpets.net with your comments and questions. Thank you for listening.